Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, April 14th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read Points of Progress, and Science and Nature is back, so I'll read that. And then the Home Forum, and then the Monitor's View. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled Safety, Balance, Tolerance, and Coexistence. This is written by Noelle Swan, who's the editor of the weekly edition, and you can email her at nswan@csmonitor.com. And she writes, in this week's cover story, writer Michael Benenev brings readers to India, where conservationists are celebrating the triumphant resurgence of big cats. Both in India and around the world, leopards and tigers are considered majestic and beautiful creatures, but they are also predators. In India's Uttarakhand state, the increase in wild cats has come with a parallel surge in violent attacks on people. This unintended consequence has sparked a spate of new questions about safety, balance, tolerance, and coexistence. On its face, this story is a uniquely Indian one, but it is a tale told the world over as communities confront the realities of initiatives designed to restore ecological balance by returning animals that had been under threat to the wild. In the United States, rewilding efforts have brought gray wolves to Colorado, red wolves to North Carolina, and grizzly bears to the North Cascades in Washington State. In South Africa, conservationists have restocked the Laskop Dam Nature Reserve with several animals whose numbers have been dwindling, including the southern white rhino. In Europe, several decades of conservation measures have led to explosions in populations of carnivores, including bears, lynx, wolves, and wolverines. Such efforts are often fueled by a desire to right an ecological wrong, but in ecosystem is not a vacuum. Reintroducing animals to the wild often means that people must, once again, learn to live with them. The tension is particularly acute with carnivores that can pose threats to people and livestock. But even herbivores can present challenges. The reintroduction of beavers, for instance, can spark backlash from farmers and homeowners who worry about potential flooding. At their root, these stories are about the interconnectedness of all living things. In the past, humanity has confronted such challenges with brute force, hence the near extinction of so many species. But with rewilding efforts, there is recognition that another way is possible. Of course, the conflicts that arise in their wake cannot be ignored. Balance must be sought. Michael's story from Uttarakhand is rich with personal details of what it is like to live with leopards and tigers. As Sanjay Sandhi, a founder of Titli Trust, a nonprofit that works on reducing human-leopard conflict, says in Michael's story, there are no easy answers, but the solution must be coexistence. You can't eliminate leopards or people. That was the From the Editor column this week, written by Noelle Swan, who is the editor of the weekly edition. And this week it was entitled Safety, Balance, Tolerance, and Coexistence. And that does lead us to the cover story. It's entitled Conserving Big Cats, Preserving Human Safety. A resurgence of leopards and tigers in northern India is a victory for conservationists. But as fatal attacks increase, local residents say, protect us, too. This is written by Michael Benevive, who is a special contributor, and they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this, and it's got the heading of safety. The number of endangered tigers in northern India has more than doubled in the past 20 years, a triumph for conservation. But as fatal attacks on humans also increase, local residents want to prioritize safety. From Uttarakhand, India. While walking to school with a classmate one day in November 2023, a teenager named Ankit stepped off the asphalt road and into the adjacent forest, seeking a bit of privacy to relieve himself. As he turned to head back to the pavement, he was slammed from behind. At first, I thought it was my friend messing around, recalls Ankit, who, like many in India, does not have a surname. But a second later, he hit the ground face down and felt a set of teeth sink into his right shoulder. I knew instantly it was a tiger. As Ankit tells it, he was dragged deeper into the forest behind a clump of bushes. The tiger adjusted its grip, setting its jaws around Ankit's head. I was sure I was going to die, he says. I was desperate. Ankit lives in the North Indian state of Uttarakhand, where lowland jungles rise into forested hills that sit below soaring Himalayan peaks. It is about the size of West Virginia. In an average week, 2 to 3 people there are attacked by big cats, according to data from the Uttarakhand Forest Department. Some 6 miles from Ankit's home, Jim Corbett National Park has the highest density of tigers anywhere in the world. An estimated 260 tigers live within it, while another 300 or so live elsewhere in Uttarakhand, for a total of 560 cats statewide, according to the most recent tiger census. For those who care about protecting tigers, these numbers are a triumph. In 2006, when India's National Tiger Conservation Authority was created, the Uttarakhand's tiger population was estimated at just 178. Nationwide, the number of tigers has also grown over the past 2 decades, from 1,411 cats in 2006 to 3,862 today, making India home to approximately 75% of the world's wild tigers. But the current intensity of conflict between people and predators has caused communities to question whether Uttarakhand's success at protecting endangered animals has come at too high a price for humans. Ankit says that, while struggling for his very life, he somehow managed to reach up and grab the tiger by the tongue. Then he pulled. Hard. The tiger, apparently surprised, released him and retreated into the jungle. Hearing his screams, his friend ran for help to a nearby Forest Department checkpost, where a few forest guards were stationed. The guards refused to go in to help the teen and wouldn't allow anyone else to try to rescue him. They said, "No one can be saved from the jaws of a tiger. He's gone." And they didn't want to risk more lives with the tiger still nearby, recounts Ankit's father, Suraj, who arrived at the scene some 30 minutes after the attack. By that time, a small crowd had gathered along the road. Suraj shouted for his son 3 times, and to everyone's shock, Ankit staggered out of the jungle. His shirt was shredded and he was covered in blood. Among other severe injuries, his scalp had been slashed open by the tiger. Ankit's father immediately stripped off his shirt and wrapped it around his son's head. Ankit remembers making it to the road, but doesn't recall feeling any pain. He was rushed to a hospital on the back of a motorcycle, sandwiched between his father, who was driving, and another man who sat behind him, holding him in place. As the number of tigers in Uttarakhand has increased, so has the number of tiger attacks. In 2023, when Ankit was mauled, the state reported 26 attacks, including 17 fatalities. In 2006, when the National Tiger Conservation Authority was formed, there were just 2, including 1 death. And tigers are not the state's only, or even most prevalent, feline threat. One afternoon in July 2024, in a small hamlet in the Himalayan foothills near the village of Ekhori, a 9-year-old girl named Poonam was playing with a neighbor. "I called over there at 5 o'clock wondering why she hadn't returned yet," Poonam's mother, Usha Devi, says. "I was told that she'd left an hour earlier." A search party was organized, and that evening Poonam's remains were discovered in the forest, a few hundred yards from her home. She'd been killed by a leopard. Over the next few months, 2 more children in the village were killed by the same leopard. Schools were closed for weeks. Cages baited with goats were placed in the forest. Camera traps were installed, and teams of hunters, known as shikaris, were dispatched. It wasn't until November that the leopard was ultimately tracked down and shot. "It was watching kids playing when they killed it," Usha Devi says. In 2024, there were 137 people attacked by leopards in Uttarakhand, according to Forest Department figures. 15 died. During a spike in attacks that fall, 5 children were reported killed over the span of 4 weeks. Schools in the villages across the state were shut due to what they called the leopard menace. Curfews were imposed. While the Forest Department estimates there are 3,100 leopards within Uttarakhand's borders, that figure is generally regarded by wildlife experts as unreliable, as no official census has ever been conducted. Many believe there are more and that the population is growing. Conservation efforts have been very successful. There's an increase in numbers and lots of leopard sightings, says Puneet Tomar, the officer in charge of Uttarakhand's Tihri Forest Division, which includes the village of Akori. Leopard encounters, too, appear to be rising. Over the past 25 years, the average number of annual attacks measured over 5-year spans has jumped from 75 to 125 per year. After a leopard or tiger kills or injures someone, the Forest Department typically pays 400,000 rupees, or about $4,600, in compensation to families. In Ankit's case, this wasn't enough to cover the cost of his medical treatment. His family says it has gone deep into debt and can't afford the further surgeries that doctors have recommended for Ankit. Others reported similar difficulties in paying for the care or with paying for the care of wounded family members. Uttarakhand currently faces a dilemma: how to continue protecting big cats while reducing human-wildlife conflict. For some, even one fatality is too many. Manish Kumar runs the Socialist People's Front, a non-governmental organization that advocates for peasants and forest dwellers, he explains. I am not against tiger conservation, he tells me at his office in Ramnagar, just outside Corbett National Park. But I am against the practice of conserving tigers at the cost of human life. He believes the government should assess the territorial needs of tigers and leopards and then determine the number of cats Uttarakhand's ecosystems can actually support. If there are more cats than resources in territory, he suggests balance hunting to reduce their populations to sustainable levels. Forest officials say, live together, Mr. Kumar says. This is impossible. When a tiger is hungry, he will eat you. There are, however, strategies that researchers and government officials alike can believe greatly reduce the number of attacks while keeping guns out of the equation. The goal of the Guidelines for Human-Leopard Conflict Mitigation, published by the Indian government in 2023, is harmonious coexistence between humans and wildlife. Sanjay Santhi, a founder of Titli Trust, a nonprofit that works on reducing human-leopard conflict in Uttarakhand, says there are no easy answers, but the solution must be coexistence. You can't eliminate leopards or people. A program run by Mr. Santhi's organization called Friends of the Leopard teaches communities nonviolent strategies that will help them stay safe. In the handful of villages where pilot projects have been launched, attacks have, in fact, dropped by 75%, Mr. Sandhi says. We've shown that it works. The issue is how to translate intent to action across the state. Big cat attacks are nothing new to the people of Uttarakhand. This is the region where Jim Corbett, for whom the park is named, rose to fame as a shikari in the early decades of the 20th century. In his classic memoirs, he recounts tracking the Champawat tiger, which reportedly killed 236 people over 4 years in the eastern part of the state, and 200 more in neighboring Nepal. He also writes of the hunt for the leopard of Rudraprayag, which claimed a reported 125 lives over 8 years. People here have a tolerance for sharing space with wild animals, said C. Ramesh, a researcher at the Wildlife Institute of India, who worked on the Guidelines for Humored Leopard Conflict Mitigation. But the tolerance level has gone down. Residents of villages where attacks have occurred say this is because the situation, as they've known it during their own lifetimes, has changed. It was not like this earlier, says Vipin Chandra Sharma, whose 19-year-old daughter, Nikita Sharma, was killed by a tiger while cutting grass in her family's field with a number of other women. She was its third victim in the area. We hear tigers or leopards growling every day. The Forest Department issued a warning 2 weeks ago saying don't go out between 4 p.m. and 9 a.m. If you get attacked, it's not our responsibility. Feeling that they have nowhere else to go, locals have had to learn to overcome their fears. I visited homes in several villages where children had been grabbed by leopards mere feet from their houses. Some survived, like Sia, who at age 8 in April of 2024 was severely injured after a leopard dragged her into the forest before releasing her. Others did not. We have seen the worst, says Kavita Devi, whose 9-year-old son, Arav Singh, was killed by a leopard while crossing the family's courtyard in Kerali village. So, what is there to be scared of? Still, she makes sure her 3 remaining children are always inside before sunset. When a big cat proves to be a danger to people, it will be trapped or tranquilized and relocated, if it can be found. Sometimes when a leopard, or much more rarely a tiger, becomes a repeat offender, the government will issue orders to shoot it. Over the past decade or so, the most prolific shikari in Uttarakhand has been Joy Hukil. By his own count, Mr. Hukil, a thoughtful and soft-spoken man with a great respect for leopards, has killed 47 of the cats. His difficult and exhausting work is an unpaid public service, and he covers his own expenses from food to ammunition. There is more conflict now than in the past, he says, at his spartanly furnished stone house, built in the town of Pauri by 19th-century American missionaries. 30 years back, there was no fear of leopards. People used to be afraid of evil spirits lurking in every corner. Nowadays, everyone has forgotten about the spirits. Mr. Hukil believes one reason leopards attack is that their base of natural prey in the forest has dwindled. It's a pity. Leopards, they're designed to eat meat. They have no other option, so they come close to human habitations, and sometimes some of them decide to kill people, he says. No one knows whether the prey base has shrunk, Mr. Tomar, the forest officer, tells me, because that hasn't been studied. Less prey may be a part of the problem, he says, but there are no numbers on how much a part of the problem it is. Even if deer are there, he continues, leopards will come out of the forest for easy prey. He thinks that when attacks occur near houses, leopards are hunting cattle and dogs, and they happen to encounter kids. Mr. Sandhi of Titli Trust says that the reasons attacks occur where they do are often a mystery. There is no difference between areas of high and low conflict. The habitats are similar, and habitat quality is similar. It just seems random, he says. Sometimes there is just no way to explain leopard behavior, he adds. There are many things we don't know. Among those things are, how much is the behavior of big cats changing? And what is their motive when they attack? In his 1944 book, Man-Eaters of Kumaon, Corbett wrote what has long been a tenet of human-tiger conflict. It is only when tigers have been incapacitated through wounds or old age that in order to live, they are compelled to take to a diet of human flesh. People, in other words, are easy prey, he believed, but healthy tigers don't bother to hunt them. For cats that do, it's a matter of survival. This no longer seems to be true, at least not with the current spate of attacks, says Dushyant Sharma, senior veterinary officer at Corbett Tiger Reserve. In charge of teams that relocate problem cats, he says, out of 20 tigers captured, only one or two is old or injured. All of the Forest Department officials I spoke with, however, reject the idea that some cats are man-eaters that deliberately hunt people. Instead, they attribute attacks to accidental encounters when a tiger or leopard is surprised by a person, or cases of mistaken identity. A leopard doesn't want to kill any child, says Dhruv Martiola, divisional forest officer in the Bageshwar area, during a phone conversation. When I talked to Pradeep Dulahakandi, another divisional forest officer in Elmora, I referred to one leopard held at the Elmora Rescue Center for over a decade as a man-eater, since it had been deemed too dangerous to release back into the wild. He immediately scolded me for using that term. But Dr. Ramesh of the Wildlife Institute of India explains that while leopards usually try to avoid contact with people, they are extremely smart, highly adaptable, and able to live very close to towns and villages. Once a leopard is habituated to human presence, its shyness will go away, he says. Many attacks are the result of surprise encounters, but leopards can learn that humans have no self-protection, that they are easy prey. And if cubs taste human flesh, they learn they can hunt humans. This knowledge, Dr. Ramesh adds, can pass from one generation of leopards to another. When I ask Mr. Hukil, the Shikari, for his thoughts, he replies, "Once a leopard kills a human and eats the body, humans are added to their menu." He dismisses the notion that leopards mistake people for other animals. Leopards can see far better than us. They are aware of who they are attacking. But he points out, they're hungry. Their numbers are in the thousands, but relatively few leopards are actually killing humans. A common assumption regarding the roots of human-wildlife conflict is that people are increasingly encroaching on wild lands and reaping the consequences. But in much of Uttarakhand, the opposite is also true. Many rural villagers are leaving remote areas for better jobs, better schools, and better health care. The crop fields that they once tended have become overgrown with brush. Situated between homes and the forest, these fields are a crucial buffer zone between humans and wildlife habitats. When they become untended or overgrown, that buffer disappears, and wild lands begin encroaching on residential areas. Attacks become more likely, and when they occur, more people move away out of fear. Human-wildlife conflict is now one of the biggest reasons for migration, and migration is the reason why these killings keep happening, Mr. Hukil says. It's a self-perpetuating cycle. One of the top tactics for reducing the conflict recommended in the guidelines for human-leopard conflict mitigation and by Friends of the Leopard is to keep fallow fields clean. Other strategies include improving lighting in villages and around homes, reducing the number of stray cattle since many people suspect they lure the predators, which then attack people instead, and improving waste management as trash draws dogs, cows, and other animals that big cats hunt. When garbage dumps are located on the periphery of or inside a village slash town, high levels of conflict may result, the guidelines note. These guidelines, however, which include ambitious proposals that could improve our understanding of leopard behavior patterns, are merely suggestions, not rules. When I asked how rural residents of Uttarakhand can be persuaded to support big cat conservation efforts despite their fears of being attacked, Mr. Sandi, Dr. Ramesh, and others reply that respect for animals is ingrained in the region's culture and the Hindu religion. This perspective can be reinforced by education, informing people about the benefits that healthy populations of apex predators have for the environment as a whole. Still, this is a project that will need patience. Any path towards harmonious coexistence must be sensitive to the fear that locals are currently living with, Dr. Ramesh says. He adds, it can seem out of touch for people in the city to say, you have to have high tolerance, when we are not the ones living with it day to day. But we need to mitigate the conflict while protecting wildlife. Many of the people I talked to who had endured the trauma of attacks by big cats can support that sentiment, but they give it a slightly different emphasis. Put all the tigers in the world in Corbett, fine, but protect us too, says Ankit's father, Suraj. If tigers are important, we people are important too. Ankit himself ultimately hopes to work for the Forest Department one day. No one tried to save me, Ankit says, but I will try to save people. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Points of Progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it, and a paragraph or two or three or sometimes four describing that point. Number one, Mexico. Eastern monarch butterflies doubled in population according to a new report. The butterflies occupy 4.42 acres in central Mexico's forests over the winter, up from 2.22 acres the previous year, the second lowest total recorded in three decades of data. These migrating pollinators need large forests for protection against weather, and scientists attribute this year's growth to less severe drought along the route from Canada and the United States to Mexico. Jorge Rickards, Director General of World Wildlife Fund Mexico, says, "It's now time to turn this year's increase into a lasting trend with an all-hands approach where governments, landowners, conservationists, and citizens continue to safeguard critical habitats along the monarch's North American migratory route." And that was from World Wildlife Fund. Number 2, United States. Oyster catcher populations have rebounded, even as other shorebirds have seen major declines. The red-billed shellfish eaters, which breed regularly on the Atlantic coast, faced falling counts from development, car traffic, and off-leash dogs disturbing habitat. Conservation efforts pushed up their numbers by 45% between 2008 and 2023, bringing the population to some 14,735 birds. The American Oyster Catcher Working Group, a partnership of 40 nonprofits and government agencies, has found success educating the public, even as encouraging behavior change means restricted human access to beaches during nesting season. "We're trying to do it in a way that has the least impact on humans but the best outcome for the birds. It's less about enforcement and more about engagement," said Shiloh Schulte, a shorebird scientist. Conservationists are now focused on how rising waters increasingly encroach upon shorebird habitat. That was from Inside Climate News, American Oyster Catcher Working Group, and Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Okay, number 3, United Kingdom. Scientists created a solar-powered device that captures carbon dioxide from the air. Carbon capture and storage have been extolled as tools in climate change mitigation, but the process typically requires a great deal of fossil fuel energy and raises uncertainty about whether storing carbon dioxide in the long term is safe. A recent paper from the University of Cambridge seeks to address both worries. Taking inspiration from photosynthesis, the new flow reactors pull CO2 from the air using specialized filters. Sunlight then heats the captured carbon, and the device converts it into syngas, a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide that can be converted into liquid fuel. The devices do not need any external power other than sunlight, and if researchers can convert the syngas into usable fuel, they would eliminate the need for storing captured carbon. And an advanced reactor could potentially allow individuals to generate their own fuel. That was from the University of Cambridge and Gizmodo. Number 4, South Sudan. Trials of a rarely grown, climate-resilient coffee are bearing fruit. In South Sudan, more than 1,000 farmers in 2021 planted seedlings of the indigenous Excelsa coffee. Deep roots and thick leaves enabled the variety to thrive in the drought and heat that have affected major coffee-producing countries in recent years. Tasters say Excelsa has a sweet flavor with notes of chocolate, dark fruits, and hazelnut. Equatoria Teak Company and international partners provided the seedlings and training to small holders practicing agroforestry, growing coffee alongside other crops. Community leaders see Excelsa as a chance for locals to gain financial independence from the government or foreign aid, but they also recognize the need for better infrastructure and stability in their country. And that was from the Associated Press and Cordaid. And last but not least, number 5, India. The government has drastically expanded road connectivity in rural areas since 2000. The Prime Minister's Rural Roads Program, billed as an effort to narrow the urban-rural income gap, resulted in the construction of some 773,000 kilometers, or 480,000 miles, of paved roads between 2000 and 2024. Increased connectivity has benefited women in particular. Women reported lower rates of domestic violence, which researchers attributed to more freedom to leave the home and greater exposure to other communities. Other studies also found that travel times decreased, workers had great mobility, and students stayed in school longer. There's no evidence that the road program boosted incomes, though analysts note a lack of research on more recent years. India has also nearly tripled its highway network to 146,000 kilometers and plans to build 62,500 more kilometers of road by 2029. And that was from The Economist, and all that was compiled by Cameron Poo and Troy Aiden Samajan, who are staff writers. And now for Science and Nature in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. And there's one article, and I will read it. It says, "Waste not, want not. How Massachusetts became the only state to reduce food waste." This is written by Troy Aiden Samajan, who is a staff writer. And they do have that paragraph, why we wrote this. It's got the heading of transformation. Many U.S. communities have taken steps to reduce food waste in recent years, but seen little progress. One state has actually managed to pull it off. Here's how. From Agawam, Massachusetts, on a recent Thursday in March, Abe Marciniak unloads 24 pallets of ice cream, enough to fill 31 refrigerators, into a machine that transforms it into fuel. Today's flavor is room temperature Rocky Road, but this facility handles all kinds of food waste from supermarkets, distribution centers, universities, and even residential drop-offs. "We get everything you can find in aisles 1 through 12, says Mr. Marciniak, site manager at Agawam Organics Recycling Facility owned and operated by Vanguard Renewables. Mr. Marciniak's recycling facility is one of 6 in the Commonwealth and only one of 25 in the United States. As the expired ice cream funnels into a turbo separator, Mr. Marciniak watches the machine strip food from its packaging. The organic waste is then trucked to a dairy farm where it's mixed with cow manure and processed into renewable natural gas. It's really a great circle, says Mr. Marciniak. Food starts at the farm, and our farm turns it back into energy. Farm to table, then back to farm. Consider day-old strawberries. Whether they spoil on a supermarket shelf or in the back of a fridge at home, they often end up in the same place, a landfill. Facilities like this one, which processes up to 250 tons of food waste daily, replace manual work done by hand or not done at all. That's a crucial step in diverting waste away from landfills. Americans throw out about 40% of food annually, a waste of both money and natural resources. Reducing food waste can increase food security, promote resource and energy conservation, and address climate change. The Bay State is the only state to significantly reduce food waste, to the tune of 13.2%, according to a 2024 study. Massachusetts was among the first 5 states to enact a food waste ban in 2014. The others were California, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Vermont. "The law has worked really well in Massachusetts," says Robert Sanders, an assistant professor of marketing and analytics at the University of California, San Diego, and co-author of the study. "That's due to 3 things: affordability, simplicity, and enforcement." Converting waste into fuel. If food waste were a country, it would be the 3rd highest emitter of greenhouse gases after China and the U.S. It's also the largest category of waste at 25% sent to landfills in the U.S. In 2019, some 66 million tons of food waste came from retail, food service, and households. Around 60% of this waste was sent to landfills, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. Vanguard Renewables specializes in turning organic waste into renewable energy. The Massachusetts-based company partners with dairy farms to convert food scraps and manure into biogas through anaerobic digestion. Microorganisms in cow manure digest organic matter, releasing biogas, a mix of methane and carbon dioxide. The gas is captured in large steel vats on the farm and refined into renewable natural gas, which can be used to heat homes and power buildings. "Basically, we harvest bug farts," says Mr. Marciniak with a laugh. "But the results are no joke. Each of Vanguard Renewables' 5 digesters produces enough energy to heat 1,600 to 3,500 homes per year." Since 2014, Vanguard has processed more than 887 tons of food waste in New England, producing enough natural gas to heat 20,000 homes for a year. By 2028, the company plans to have more than 50 systems across the country, baking food recovery into every part of the business. In Western Massachusetts, Amherst College has become a model for limiting food waste at the source. Last year, it was recognized as the winner in the zero waste category in the Campus Race to Zero Waste case study competition. The goal has been to push us aggressively to make sure everything is compostable, says Weston Drips, Director of Sustainability. The school has phased out single-use plastics, to-go boxes, and even canned water, replacing them with refill stations and compostable materials. In 2023, Amherst College generated 238 tons of food waste, roughly 4 to 5 tons per week. But instead of ending up in landfills, Vanguard collected 100% of that waste and processed it at its Agawam facility. That total includes both pre-consumer waste, such as kitchen scraps, and post-consumer waste, like leftover scraped off plates in the dining hall. To really have a clean waste stream, we have to focus on the front end, says Mr. Drips. Amherst's approach goes beyond composting. Each month, the school donates 2,000 to 3,000 pounds of frozen surplus food to the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts, ensuring edible food reaches those in need. Commercial businesses, too, are finding ways to cut waste. Maura Dugan, founder of and CEO of Fancy Pants Baking Company, knows firsthand how much food can go to waste in her industry. Her company produces hundreds of thousands of cookies each week. At its Walpole facility, Fancy Pants has large totes from Vanguard, which collect burnt cookies, food scraps, and anything that can't be donated or sold. Last year, Fancy Pants diverted about 22 tons of waste. Ms. Dugan says the totes serve as a daily reminder that sustainability isn't an afterthought. It can be baked into every part of the business. I'm sure we can do better. For Massachusetts to hit its 2030 goal of reducing food waste disposal by 780,000 tons per year, it has to double its rate of waste diversion. Back in Agawam, Mr. Marciniak passes by 275-gallon totes full of leafy vegetables. Every day, he faces the reality that Americans waste 92 billion pounds of food a year, enough to make 145 million meals. It really makes you think about the things that we take for granted, he reflects. Millions of people are starving everywhere, and the amount of food waste in this country is substantial, says Mr. Marciniak. I'm sure we can do a better job. There's a bullet here. It says questions, comments, email the science team at sci@csmonitor.com. And now for the home forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There's one article, and here it is. It's entitled, I Ran from the Law to Run a Rural Farm. The work is grueling, and animals can get ornery, but farming has enriched our life in ways untold. This is written by John Clarr. Mark Twain's famous satire, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, chronicles the fictitious time travel of an engineer named Hank Morgan from East Hartford, Connecticut. After being struck in the head with a crowbar, he awakens in 6th century England and works his way into King Arthur's favor by using his modern knowledge. I have a similar tale, except it is true. I am an attorney admitted since 1989 to the Connecticut Bar. I graduated from high school in East Hartford. I was struck in the head, not with a crowbar, but with a chronic illness. I did not wake up under a tree being challenged to a joust by a medieval knight, as in Twain's tale. I woke up owning a former dairy farm in Vermont's wild Northeast Kingdom, where my family and I moved so that I could recuperate. Our journey into the world of farming entailed a complete cultural re-education for my family, including my 3 children. Most American grade schoolers aren't helping mom and dad perform an emergency procedure on a sheep that just had delivered her lambs, nor are they bouncing around in a tractor, seatbelt free, at age 12. Or, for that matter, herding bulls, exploring ancient barns, or raising rabbits for consumption. Our 160-acre farm was in Barton, Vermont, where temperatures hit 39 degrees below zero one winter, before wind chill, and those Vermont winds sure can howl. We started with chickens. We added goats and then sheep, pigs, cows. Most of our neighbors were farmers, loggers, or homesteaders. Once they accepted the Flatlanders from Connecticut, the community was extremely warm and supportive, offsetting those Arctic blasts. My Vermont nickname became Old MacDonald because at one point, we tended 4 draft horses, 70 milking cows, 40 pigs, 100 sheep, and 20-odd beef and dairy cows. One of the most transformative insights occurred around food. After just a year or two of farming, I came in from haying to a dinner prepared by my wife, Jackie. I looked at the table and realized that everything on it came from our farm. The chicken legs, the vegetables, the milk, the butter, and it all tasted better than anything we could buy in a store. This self-sufficiency became a pursuit of its own. Jackie and I would play a game of seeing how many weeks we can go without visiting the grocery store, a tradition we learned was practiced by many Vermont farmers, perhaps for generations. One day, our neighbor Claude, whose family previously owned our Barton Dairy in the 1920s, stopped by to visit. Claude is legendary for using draft horses to run cable for utility companies. He walked into the living room, saw our 5-year-old daughter, and asked, "What you eating, Em?" Without pausing between bites of her pork chop, grease glistening on her chin, our little girl nonchalantly remarked to the grizzled old farmer, "Spotty." Besides matter-of-factness, hard work, regardless of age, is implicit in farming. Our 3 children helped us harvest hay, feed and milk animals, haul water, and shovel manure. We offered no wages or allowance. They were taught this was the price of their dinners. They worked 7 days a week and learned that complaining did not make their labors easier, but harder. By the time each of them reached age 12, our children could outwork most grown men, and they knew it. I never planned to farm for the benefit of my children, but our low-income, arduous, cold, adversarial venture became a way of life that shaped our children to be self-reliant, tough, hardworking adults. They live in gratitude, not resentment. They embrace challenges with purpose and joy. Now, our son, Joe, is raising his 2 sons with the same skill sets and love of rugged work and the outdoors. In his historical novel, Twain contrasted the culture of 6th century England with the perceived enlightenment of his late 19th century era. What he found was entirely unexpected, much like my transition from a suit and tie law practice to a barnyard in Vermont. To be sure, the work can be grueling, the hardships of animal care can be traumatic, and I rarely get a day off. But I have found the simple lives of rural Vermonters to be rich with originality, frugality, and innovative practicality. In their unpretentious lives, my Vermont neighbors and my experiences tending a country farm have taught me more meaningful lessons than I ever learned in law school. And my children have learned them, too. And finally, I say in jest, we are at the Monitor's View section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. And there are 2 articles, and I'll read them both. And these are articles written by the editorial staff. The first one, Syrians Reweave Their Identity. Among all the countries offering models of reconciliation after long conflicts, Syria is now trying to make its mark. A good example is a grassroots rescue organization known as the White Helmets. During a severe but short flare-up of sectarian violence in early March, the group's volunteers quickly entered the killing zone in a minority area to help any and all, conducting around 30 responses a day. "When we go to rescue someone in need, we don't ask them about their religion or political opinion," said Abdulkafi Kale, head of the group's operations in the coastal region where the killings took place. "Our mandate is to help those in need," he told the BBC. A reporter from the BBC was able to join the Syria Civil Defense, as the White Helmets are formally known, as it went about its humanitarian missions. What was clear is that such acts of equality and kindness are the necessary building blocks for a country starting over. "We considered ourselves as an umbrella to serve all Syrians," Mr. Kyle said. Civil society groups like the White Helmets are proving to be far more effective at binding Syrians than the new interim government or former rebel leader Ahmed al-Sharaa. While his Islamist group was able to overthrow a dictatorship in early December, it has struggled to assure Syrians that it can achieve political inclusion regardless of ethnicity or religion. On March 29th, President al-Sharaar did announce a new and broader cabinet that is far more representative of Syrian society, a nod by him to pressure from civil society and foreign countries to provide more inclusive government. Civil society is always closer to the people than government administrations. We know people's needs and opinions, Bayan Scaff of the activist youth group Quatwa, or STEP, told the Monitor's Taylor Luck. In many cities, volunteers are forming local councils to meet basic needs or hosting inclusive town halls to prevent the kind of revenge attacks of March 6th through 10th. As the de facto first responders in violent incidents or simply a fire emergency, the White Helmets and their 3,500 volunteers are emphasizing the need for impartial organizations to provide safety and a path towards justice. For almost six decades, while living under a dictatorship, reports The Atlantic, Syrians have been taught to hate and fear one another. Now, local civil society groups are filling a political void, trying to keep anarchy and anger at bay. The White Helmet volunteers who rush to scenes of violence and hatred are, as Mr. Kyle said, showing that it doesn't matter if a Syrian is a Muslim, Sunni, Alawite, Christian, Druze, or even an atheist. Those families are our families. And the next and last Monitor's View article is entitled Rallies for Innocence in Gaza. For 2 days in late March, hundreds of Palestinian civilians marched against Hamas in several cities. It was the largest protest against the militant group since it sparked a war with Israel more than 17 months ago. Clearly, the fear of harsh retribution by Hamas for speaking out is falling among the territory's 2 million residents as they face further war destruction. Yet more telling was what partly drove protesters to set aside their fears, a claim of innocence. In one video on the social platform X, a man in the northern city of Beit Lahia yells to a crowd, "We are a peaceful people. We just want to live." One construction worker told a German press agency, "We shouldn't have to keep paying the price for leaders who only care about their own power." A slogan on one sign read, "We refuse to be the ones who die." Such statements point to the fact that Hamas purposely embeds its leaders, fighters, and weapons inside civilian buildings to draw Israeli bombs, a clear violation of international law. For its part, the Israel military says it tries to follow the rules of war by giving proper warning to civilians to flee an area before bombing a Hamas site. People have realized that Hamas is using them as pawns and human shields, nothing more. Hamza Hawidi, a peace activist from Gaza, told the Times of Israel last year, "They have realized that Hamas's only strategy is to maximize civilian casualties." Many in Gaza may be emboldened to speak out after an edict last year from a prominent Muslim scholar, Salman Al-Daya. He said Hamas failed to keep its fighters away from the homes of defenseless Palestinian civilians. Some experts say wars often end when people caught in a conflict start to empathize with innocent victims on both sides. That realization is behind the Geneva Conventions of 1949 that prohibit the use of civilians as shields. Many in Gaza are now trying to turn their innocence into a shield, one that may help end this war. Well, we've got about 8.5 minutes left, so I'll read the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What are the top U.S. cybersecurity concerns? This is written by Caitlin Babcock. Amid the threats facing the United States, cybersecurity doesn't make flashy daily headlines, but the latent danger from digital threats has some government officials on alert. The chair of the House Committee on Homeland Security named cybersecurity a top priority earlier this year. Former FBI Director Christopher Wray has called Chinese hacks the defining threat of our generation. Foreign hackers interfering against the U.S. worries Democrats and Republicans alike. A string of Chinese hacks into government agencies, infrastructure systems, and telephone companies in recent years has raised alarm bells, including a disclosure in December 2024 that hackers with ties to the Chinese government broke into the U.S. Treasury Department's systems. In her Senate confirmation hearing, Department of Homeland Security head Kristi Noem called cyber attacks a rising threat that demands our utmost attention. Yet the Trump administration has taken early actions that undermine longstanding cybersecurity efforts, critics argue. In the middle of all this, President Donald Trump is trying to chart his course on cybersecurity policy, sometimes sending mixed messages about his intentions. With the growing focus on cybersecurity, here's a look at some of the issues government officials are looking to address. And what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: what cybersecurity concerns does the U.S. face? Answer: risks are present in both the private and public sectors. One in three CEOs globally recently cited cyber espionage and loss of sensitive information as their top concern. Ransomware attacks, in which hackers block access to a computer system until its users pay a ransom, is a growing concern. These types of attacks rose worldwide by 74% in 2023, with the U.S. most heavily targeted, according to the former Director of National Intelligence under President Joe Biden. The U.S. also faces a shortage of around 500,000 workers in cybersecurity, although some argue that advances in artificial intelligence could reduce the need for cybersecurity professionals. Then there are foreign actors. Last summer, hackers employed by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps were able to breach Mr. Trump's presidential campaign, stealing confidential information. In October, the U.S. disrupted a Russian cyber attack on Defense Department and State Department computers. But China is outpacing both those countries, as it is responsible for more hacks globally than Russia, North Korea, and Iran combined. The Chinese government often operates through groups of contractors, sometimes called hackers for hire, who are paid to find vulnerabilities within U.S. data systems and infrastructure. Question: what kind of hacks are involved? Answer: two of the biggest names among these hackers for hire are Salt Typhoon and Volt Typhoon. Microsoft assigns these names in order to keep track of the groups. Last fall, reporting uncovered that Salt Typhoon has been carrying out a series of damaging cyber attacks since as early as 2022. The hackers targeted at least 9 telecommunications firms, including Verizon and AT&T. Richard Forno, a cybersecurity expert at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, says these hacks probably don't present an immediate threat to the average person, but they give China an informational edge. Telecommunications and internet infrastructure underpins so much of our modern society, says Dr. Forno. So, if you can penetrate and potentially disrupt that infrastructure, you have all sorts of follow-on effects down the road. Volt Typhoon presents a different kind of threat. In 2023, this hacking group, which is also tied to the Chinese government, was able to penetrate infrastructure such as transportation, water, and energy systems across the U.S. Once they gained access, hackers implanted malware, malicious software that can essentially lie dormant until China wants to activate it. In early 2024, the FBI announced it had disrupted this attack by removing malware from hundreds of home and office internet routers. But the U.S. is still determining the scope of these attacks. Many security experts and public officials warn that China could use them as a tool in the event of a conflict, for example, if China invaded Taiwan and wanted to limit the U.S. reaction. China traditionally takes a very long, patient view of espionage and warfare, says Dr. Forno. Question: what is President Trump's stance on cybersecurity? Answer: the Trump administration seems to be prioritizing an offensive approach to cybersecurity. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz has suggested imposing higher costs and harsher consequences on nations that carry out cyber attacks. The new head of a key federal cybersecurity agency, Sean Plankey, said he expects more pointed measures at our adversaries. President Trump has also been reshaping digital security institutions within the federal government. Shortly after taking office, he dissolved the Cyber Safety Review Board, a Biden-created commission that had been investigating the Salt Typhoon hacks. He also oversaw more than 100 layoffs at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, including some employees who were tracking the efforts of Salt Typhoon and Volt Typhoon, according to media reports. Some employees have reportedly been rehired and put on probationary leave. However, Reuters has reported that in early March, the White House sent a memo directing federal agencies not to fire their cybersecurity teams. And the final question, what are some concerns about the Trump administration's cybersecurity practices? And the final answer, some early actions of the Trump administration are raising red flags among cybersecurity analysts. Recently, senior officials, including Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, drew bipartisan criticism for posting details of a pending U.S. military strike in group text messages on Signal, an encrypted commercial messaging app. The conversation was revealed after a journalist was accidentally added to the group. A National Security Council spokesperson confirmed the authenticity of the text chain. Mr. Hegseth denies posting classified information. Yet officials use Signal even though the Department of Defense warned that this app has a vulnerability that Russian hackers are trying to exploit, NPR reported. The quick pace at which the Department of Government Efficiency workers have been given access to highly sensitive databases like the Treasury payment system has also generated controversy. Whether the DOGE team is following security protocols is unclear. Violating protocols could increase risks of foreign actors leveraging mistakes for their own gain. For instance, two federal employees filed a lawsuit accusing the Office of Personnel Management of using an unauthorized private server to send DOGE email blasts across the government. But OPM lawyers argued in a court filing that this email system doesn't pose a security risk because it operates entirely on government computers and doesn't use a non-government server. And briefly here, we have some statistics from the Numbers in the News column. 74, that's the percentage of surveyed European Union citizens who say that membership in the bloc is beneficial to their country, a record high since the question was first posed in 1983. They cited the EU's role in guarding peace and security as critical benefits. And $107 billion, that's the amount of dollars revenue reported by Chinese electric vehicle maker BYD last year, up from about $83 billion in 2023. Seen as a rising star in the EV world, it overtook Tesla's 2024 revenue of about $97.7 billion while touting cheaper models and faster charging stations. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.